But Father, we want to feel, we want to experience what it means to be your church and how to live out your purposes for us as a church together. We ask for Jesus' sake. Amen. Okay, so we're going to go to the same two verses. Last week we did, you are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for God's own possession, that you may proclaim the excellencies of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. So we went through who we are, chosen race, royal priesthood, holy nation. So that's our identity. Today we're going to go into the purpose of our identity, what our purpose is. What is the purpose of our life? So a lot of people, when you ask about purpose of life, if you ask the average person, you will say to be happy, right? If you look at the American Constitution, it will actually say you actually have to have the pursuit of happiness in it. It's one of enshrined constitutionally. So we have this, other people say important thing in life is not really happiness, it's actually meaning in life. Now, happiness, what is happiness? Anybody know? Just, can I ask anybody here? What is happiness? What is happiness to you? Anyone? What? Joyful, yeah, some parts of it. What else? Peace of mind. Peace of mind, yes. What else? No worries. What else?
Healthy.
What?
Healthy.
Healthy, yeah. All right, so I think that's very good. There's feeling good. Is that part of it? Life is easy, right? Good physical health. Money to buy. Got money, no stress. Right? So, I mean, these are the traditional ideas of what happiness is. And to a large extent, all of us seek that, isn't it? It's actually a physiological drive, all right, which you actually, you know, have to satisfy. There's a difference between us and an orangutan. The difference is we actually need meaning and purpose. An orangutan just has a satisfaction of drives. If I'm hungry, makan. You feel sexy, he has the female chimpanzee. It's just basically a satisfaction of drives. And a satisfaction of drives is an emotion that's felt here and now. Well, for human beings, our experience extends beyond happiness. We actually have this issue of meaning and purpose, which transcends yourself. It's bigger than yourself. And it connects the past, the present, and the future. If you're actually looking at happiness, it's just, I'm happy now. Tomorrow I'm not happy. I must be happy. So I just get a fixer, basically. Where else? Meaning is something that you actually have that actually links the past to the present to the future. Very, very important. It's something very uniquely human. So Winston Churchill says it's not important to have lived. We should have been determined to live for something. So meaning of life is important. In fact, to look at meaning of life, we look at some elderly people, look at some scientific studies on elderly people. This is a study in the UK, Britain. And they looked, it's called the English Longitudinal Aging Study. And they looked at 7,300 adults over the age of 50. So many of us here will qualify. And every 2 years, they would be interviewed and medical tests would be done. The average score, actually what they do is they rate their meaning in life as a worthwhile score. So actually the worthwhile score was quite good. The average worthwhile score was 7.41, whereas 10 was the maximum number. And they looked at the correlation between the worthwhile scores and other modalities, all right? So the ones who had more worthwhile scores or meaning in life had stronger personal relationships, broader social engagements, more cultural activity and volunteering, felt less lonely, better mental health, and better physical health. On the contrary, if you look at the other opposite of why people don't want to live, you look at veterans who are basically in the UK and they basically have depression. So 110 depressed veterans, diagnostic interviews and self-reported questionnaires, and they actually found that life meaning is associated with suicidal ideation among depressed veterans. So the ones who are depressed, okay, didn't have, and basically when they were suicidal, it was associated with a lack of meaning in life. So this actually tells you how important meaning is. If you look at famous people, so Terry Pratchett, for example, very famous, I think he's an author or something, in the UK. And he says, my meaning in life is to fulfill your potential. If you know fully the meaning of life is to find your gift, is happiness. If you don't find it, it's misery. Maya Angelou, anybody know who Maya Angelou is? First female black director, okay, in the U.S., a poet. She says, I found that among others, it's benefits giving life, other benefits, giving liberates the soul for the giver. So for her, basically, giving is the meaning of life. If you look at Steven Pinker, who is a professor of psychology in Harvard University, he's a psychologist. His idea is moral goodness. Morality is not just any old topic in psychology, but close to our concept of the meaning of life. For him, psychology, the meaning of life is basically moral goodness. Albert Einstein, you know who are his favorites for? And his meaning of life is actually questioning the world. The important thing is not to stop questioning. Curiosity has its own reason for existing. See, so everybody in the world who's ever been successful has to find some sort of meaning in their life. Because if you don't have that kind of meaning, you're not an animal. If you're an animal, you basically just satisfy your desires, your drives, and then that's it. You don't have, for each of these people, very moral goodness, giving, fulfilling your potential. These concepts can touch the past, the present, and the future. There's a line which you can draw. And that actually brings in fulfillment. Now, if you look at a study on grandparents, how many of you think that you should, as grandparents, look after your grandchildren on a regular basis? Put your hands up. One. Hey, can I see the hands? One only, huh? Okay, put your hand up properly, huh? Those of you who are not grandparents, put your hand down. Those of you who are grandparents think you should regularly look after your grandkids, put your hands up. I only see two. All right, only two. All right. So now, if you actually look at some of you, I want to put the hands up all the way, grandparents who think you've done enough already, right? Time to travel, your business already, right? So you don't need to look after your grandkids. Put your hands up. One, two, three, four, five. Wow, majority. Well, this is the study published 2017, all right, in the Berlin, German aging study. 516 grandparents interviewed with two-year medical tests between 1990 and 2009. I want you to look at the graph. These are grandparents that regularly look after their grandchildren. This is how long they live. These are non-caregiving grandparents, and also like non-grandparents like me. Do you notice any difference? Yeah, your survival, jipuan, half. Right? All right? So in 10 years, 50% of your caregiving grandparents would have died. In 5 years, half of them would have died as well, you know, non-care parents. So basically, bottom line is that all those who put your hands up, just the two of you, you will live very long. The rest of you will live a short, hopefully happy life. And then they also looked at grandparents who actually gave instrumental help to their children, which in this study, instrumental help was what? Helping with housework. Oh my goodness, got to cook for my children again. Right? So those are grandparents who helped their children by cooking and doing housework. Those who did not help their children at all, live far away, just go traveling, and you can find again half the lifespan. So bottom line, there's something about helping people, isn't it? That meaning, you know, meaning and happiness are not necessarily the same thing. You remember this beautiful movie called Lion King, The Circle of Life, and Mufasa is standing there, and he's got this young pup called Simba, and then, you know, he's talking about life, and he actually says, Simba, remember who you are. You are more than what you have become. And Simba was trying to run away from all his responsibilities. He ran off with Pumbaa. What's the one called? A pig. Is it a pig? And what's the other guy? Rafit. Yeah, anyway, he ran away from his responsibilities. But later on, he came back because resuming his responsibilities as Mufasa's son was what he was meant to be, because that's what he was born to be. And basically the advice was, Simba, remember you who you are. You are more than what you have become. All right? So we have an identity, and the purpose is that you may proclaim the excellencies of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. The word is proclamation. In Greek, it is to tell forth, divulge, publish, to declare abroad, and to celebrate. So proclamation is actually a response. It is not a directive. It is a response to something. When you see something, your response to beauty and grace of who God is, you have no choice. You actually have to respond. God made us in his image. And when we are made in his image, we have got the three R's. We learn how to be, actually are genetically primed to respond, to reflect, and also to represent God. This is what we are called to be. And if you look, when we are responding appropriately, happiness and meaning coincide. And when happiness and meaning coincide, you get joy. Joy is not necessarily happiness. All right? You can actually have a life of meaning and joy, but not necessarily happy. Ask all those people sitting here, we've got children age of about 2 to about 10. Most of them are very unhappy. Because they cannot go anywhere, they cannot do this and cannot do that. But they still find meaning, isn't it? And there is a quiet joy that's there. So the intersection of what we're looking for is meaning, and happiness actually joins, and it's actually joy. And basically the joy is basically given to us as the ultimate is actually the worship. Worship is our ultimate response of our church to God. Now, why do we worship? Why is God also interested in worshiping him? Let me give you a couple of questions which I got from John Piper. He writes, why did God create us? Anybody look at a verse and tell me? Why did God create us? Huh? For what? For his glory. Whose glory? Yours, ah? It's his. Okay, second question. Why did God choose a people for himself and make Israel his possession? Read the verse and tell me. Why did God choose a people for himself and make Israel his possession? Nothing to do, ah? Look at the verse and tell me the answer. As for the loin cloth clings to the waist of a man, I made the whole house of Israel, the whole house of Judah cling to me, declares the Lord, that they might be for me a people, a name, a praise, a glory, but they would not listen. So what are they created for? For his glory. Next question. Why did God rescue them from bondage in Egypt? Anyone? Oh, Morita-san, tell me why. She's very good. She's been with us for years. He rescued them. For what? For his namesake. That they may, he might make known his mighty power. Because by parting the Red Sea, it's a miracle, isn't it? Who gets the glory? God. Why did God use his sovereign power to bring back his people from exile after punishing them for generations of sin? And you read, for my name's sake, I defer my anger. For the sake of my praise, I restrain it for you. For my own sake, I do it. For how should my name be profaned? My glory I will not give another. So why did he bring his people back from exile? For his own sake, for his glory. Do you start to understand why worship is important? Why did the Son of God come to earth to his final decisive hour? John says, Father, the hour has come, glorify your Son, so that the Son may glorify. So why did Jesus die on the cross? To glorify the Father. Oh my goodness, if you look at all this, and why will Jesus come again in the great day of consummation, in his final decisive hour? He will come back again on that day to be glorified in his saints and to be marveled in all who have believed. He's coming back to a victory parade, right? To be glorified, correct? Wow. Suppose your kids came back from Sunday school and they bring a big banner saying God loves himself more than he loves you. True or false? It is actually true. But why is this God like a millennial? Like some of us, me generation. Why is God so, he's so like, you know, full of himself. Why does God exist? What is the chief end of God? Is God self-centered or insecure? I mean, you know, why everything about him? So why is it always about him, as it were? As if God is a millennial. Now, the question can be answered very simply. What could God give us to enjoy that we show him most loving? That's the most living thing. Yeah, what is the most loving thing that he could have given us? Okay? Now, let me give you an example to answer this. All right? Now, suppose you actually have a football team. Anybody recognize this football team? Football players here? Nobody recognize, ah? Never watch the English league? Come? Huh? Manchester United, red color, lah. Huh? Queen Park Rangers. Queen Park Rangers and is owned by Tony Fernandez. So if the Queen Park Rangers win, who gets the glory? Tony. Oh, they also get glory, each individual player, right? Supposing they had a big game, Norwich versus Queen Park Rangers. Half time, Norwich is up 3 goals, Queen Park Rangers down 1 goal, right? So what can Tony do for them? What is the most loving thing Tony can give to them? Guess, the best player in the world. Who do you think that is? Messi. So you go and fly from Barcelona, bring Messi in, right? Let's say we live in a very funny world and the best player in the world is actually number one. Now, he owns the football team, right? And he's also the best player in the world, right? What is the most loving thing Tony can do for Queen Park Rangers? He'll play la. He'll win la. And he'll also get the glory. So in a sense, that's what worship is, isn't it? The most valuable player in the world is actually God. And God gives you the most beautiful present in the world. Who is that? That's him. And so that's why when we actually look at this idea of everything for the glory of God, isn't because he's so self-centered, so full of himself, very axi, we have to go and bow before him, otherwise he'll strike us dead. Actually, it's the most loving thing he can do is to give himself to us and for us to discover how beautiful he is. He's a God that creates beauty, that every part of his creation actually reflects beauty and responds to beauty. This is a Western Australian bird, very funny bird, you know. It's called the bower bird. Very funny, because when he actually has a mating ceremony, that's his wife, and he builds a little nest. Very funny, you know. A lot of other species will have a mating dance where they show how powerful they are for genetic purposes. The more stronger and more powerful you are, the more likely you'd get a mate, right? So that you could, you know, propagate your species. This fellow, you know how he does his courting dance? He decorates aesthetically the nest, right? Because he likes beauty. Look. All right? It's a very unique bird, which assumes that the lady bird can actually appreciate beauty, you know. Not, you know, most other animals, look at how powerful you are, so my babies can run very fast and survive. This one loves beauty. Look at that. This one loves money. It's a more commercial, you know what I mean? All right? This is Jeffrey Voss, a former atheist. And he basically is a professor of biology at Westmont College. And he actually wrote in an article in Christianity Today, when he was an atheist before, and he saw the beautiful sunset and beauty of nature, this is what he wrote. This is so beautiful. There's something there that I don't yet have and I don't yet see. And I think that was Jesus. He said, I wanted to be grateful, but I didn't have anybody to be grateful to. So you're going to see and take in a beautiful sunset, a beautiful beach and lake, and then you just want to shout out something, isn't it? Because you have to see, we are designed like the bower bird to respond to beauty. We are actually made to respond to beauty. And he didn't know, looking at the sunset, that that beauty was Jesus. He wanted to be grateful, but didn't know anybody to be grateful to. C.S. Lewis writes, "I think we delight to praise what we enjoy because the praise not merely expresses but completes the enjoyment. It is its appointed consummation. It's not out of compliment that lovers keep telling one another how beautiful they are, but the delight is incomplete until it is expressed." So basically, what he is saying is that we delight to praise what we enjoy because the praise not merely expresses, but it completes the enjoyment. The fact that somebody takes you to a nice place and you have a nice char kway teow, it's not enough to enjoy the char kway teow, but you tell half your neighborhood about half char kway teow, actually completes the enjoyment. If you just ate the char kway teow by yourself, 15 plates on your own, and tell nobody about it, you actually don't actually have the enjoyment. We're actually designed to express. Okay, this is Ray Charles. It's very interesting what he wrote. He never understood all the whooping and hollering that he saw people engage in church. And then in his twilight years, he said, now he now understood that it wasn't God who needed to hear the whooping and hollering, but it was we who needed to do it, to praise something or someone greater than ourselves, that in doing so is the normal part of the human experience. So praise not merely expresses, but it completes the enjoyment. It's appointed consummation, just like the writing of a love letter or a serenading or yisang or enjoying or responding to something beautiful is actually praise and worship. So we all praise something. We have to worship something. Some it's royalty. If it's not, then it's Korean pop stars or the great leader or a great football player. We all have to worship something in high esteem. C.S. Lewis writes, when men are forbidden to honor a king, they honor millionaires, athletes, film stars instead, even famous prostitutes or gangsters. For spiritual nature, like bodily nature, will be served. To deny it food, it will gobble poison. So what C.S. Lewis is saying, that it's in our nature to worship. It's our nature to honor. If it's not a millionaire, it'll be an athlete. If it's not an athlete, it'll be a prostitute or something. And in fact, if you look at the famous drug lord, Pablo Escobar, he killed hundreds and thousands of people in his country. The whole country was converted to a drug state. When he died, thousands of people came up to show respect to a bloodthirsty drug lord. In Penang a few days ago, Bosku was there. Man who has stolen billions of dollars. And why all the Penang fellow come up there and to take selfie with him? Something about people in Penang. All right, so if we don't, then we will take food, we will gobble poison. Jeremiah says their idols are like scarecrows in the cucumber field. They cannot speak. They have to be carried. Do not be afraid of them. They cannot do no evil. Neither is in them to do good. They are both stupid and foolish. Instruction of idols is but wood. And in fact, nowadays, as we're going into the tech world, we're going to have an AI god. This is a chap who used to work for Uber. And he's Anthony Lewandowski. He says his aim is to develop and promote a realization of a godhead based on artificial intelligence, and through understanding and worship of Godhead, contribute to the betterment of society. They believe with artificial intelligence, by the time 2040, you would have more information and knowledge than the 7 billion people in the world together. All right? And using that, you could actually create an AI God. In fact, this guy from California has an AI program which types in multiple verses in the Bible, then the AI will write its own Bible. And this is a sample. And let thy companies deliver thee, but will with my own arm save them even unto this land from the kingdom of heaven. So AI can mimic Bible language in a sense. So AI will provide the information we need for our daily lives. It will pass this information for us and enlighten us in ways which may seem familiar to anyone who practices religion such as Christianity, in terms of extending what God would do way back then to what God would do today. So what AI will do is they look through all the Bible verses and tell you what God did in the past, and using that, using artificial intelligence, predict what God will do in the future. So therefore, if you worship the AI God, then you'll be able to predict the stock market, you'll be able to live longer and all that, as it were. But Jeremiah says, every man is stupid and without knowledge. Every goldsmith put to shame by his idols, for his images are false and there are no breath in them. They're worthless, a work of delusion. At the time of their punishment, they shall perish. And he says, thus shall you say to them, the gods who did not make the heavens and earth shall perish from the earth and from under the heavens. It is he who made the earth by his power, who established the world by his wisdom, and by his understanding stretched out the heavens. AI never created the world. AI is a creation of man. They're confusing the role of God. They think God is an agent to mark out a path to success. Well, God is somebody we respond to in terms of worship. So, what is worship? Well, worship is a response to who God is and what he has done for us. It's that you may proclaim the excellencies of him who called you out of darkness into marvelous light. Romans 12 says, I appeal to you therefore, brothers, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God, which is your spiritual worship. So what is worship? Worship is basically a lifestyle promoting the glory of God. So the whole universe is about God. How you live is to promote God's glory. And so therefore, when you talk about missions, it's not the Great Commission, nor is it the Great Suggestion. Worship missions is basically an extension of our worship. If you look at Genesis chapter 1, when God created the world, what was his purpose? He told man to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it. Genesis 12, the covenant God made with Abraham, I will bless you, and him who dishonors you, I will curse, and in you all the families of the earth shall be. So God intends that every corner of the world will worship him. Isaiah, is it too light a thing that you should be a servant to raise up the tribes of Jacob and bring back the preserved of Israel? I will make you a light for the nations. My salvation may reach the ends of the earth. That's what it's all about. So the goal of missions is to promote God's glory in the nations. And worship will always result in missions. Missions must always produce worship. So if you're worshiping and you love God, and you're responding to God, then you want people in Subang Jaya, KL, beyond, Indonesia, everywhere in the world to worship God together, all right? And our motivation is that once you were not a people, but now you are God's people, once you had not received mercy, now you have received mercy. This is actually taken from the prophecy of Hosea. Hosea's three children, he was asked to marry a prostitute, okay? To basically enact the adultery of Israel, all right? And his three children born was named after his punishment for the people of Israel. This one is called, I Will Punish. This one has a no mercy and not my people at all. And instead, what happens that on that day, I will answer, declares the Lord, I will answer for heavens, they will answer the earth. The earth shall answer the grain, the wine, and the oil, and they shall answer Jezreel. I will show her for myself, and I will have mercy on no mercy. I will say to not my people, you are my people. So he's actually reversing the curse. This one is called no mercy, not my people, I will punish. So instead of no mercy, I will have mercy, not my people, these are my people. So basically, the people who had not mercy before, God will have mercy. And this describes who? Not only the apostate Israel, it describes all of us. We are Gentiles. We had not received mercy before, and now we will receive mercy. So it's one thing looking at beauty far away, right? And you wolf whistle, you blow, or whatever. But when the beauty comes to you, basically, here is Meghan Markle, Duchess of Sussex, I think. You know, it's different from so admiring from far. When this beauty comes into your midst and interacts with you, it actually changes you. Another picture of this gentleman. You know this fellow? Curtis Stone, celebrity chef, isn't it? It's one thing watching him doing MasterChef. And he's got another program where he actually meets you outside in the shop, supermarket, follows you home, you know. Follows you home to do what? To cook for you. And once you cook for him, he cooked for you, what, you know, happened to you? You become a what? A fan. You love him. Why? Because Curtis Stone is different from far away. When courtesy crew come into your kitchen and use your pot and use your strainer and use your stove and take a picture with you, it completely transforms you. And what Jesus is saying, worship is actually the motivation for this is actually God, who is so beautiful, wonderful, would you respond to, but actually comes into your house and transforms you. And that becomes the motivation of the worship that you actually have. This Salvation Army, the message is based on the Bible. The ministry is motivated by the love of God. His mission is to preach the gospel of Jesus Christ and to meet human needs in His name without discrimination. So the motivation for us to worship and to spread the message is actually God's love. God's love always draws us in and always sends us out. It never stays. If God's love comes to you in your lives when you hear the message week after week in Gamma, the bottom line is that it must result in you reaching out. Because if you didn't reach out, that's not the appropriate response. Because good news and beauty is something to be shared. If you're really excited, you go and share. If you're not really excited, you'll tell nobody about it. Right? I mean, this is a Kachin people in Burma. And then many of them are actually here as refugees. And you can find most of them were actually Christians. And how this happened was in 1890, is a couple, Swedish couple from America called Minnie and Ola Hansen. And what they did is they went there to bring the gospel to the Kachin people. And actually the king of Burma actually said to them, "You see my dogs there? You got more chance converting my dogs than you can convert the Kachin people, because they're horrible people. They're bloodthirsty. They're fighting all the time. They're totally the worst people in the world." But within a few years, they actually, the Kachin people had no written language, all right? And within a few years, about 30 years, they actually translated and created 25,000 words. New Testament translated in 1911 and 1926, the Old Testament was translated. They spent their whole lives there. And when they finished the whole Bible, they wrote these words: "It is with heartfelt gratitude that I lay this work at the feet of my master. I'm conscious of the defects of my work. I've tried to master Kachin and make a translation intelligible to all of us. Pray with us that our divine master may bless this work for the salvation of the whole Kachin race." And this work has tremendous implications. You've got an average Kachin person who actually is a refugee here. They're all Christian, you know, actually. They still fight, I think, you know, if you actually get to know some of them. But the gospel goes out. And this is a couple that's actually, it's the act of worship. You see, they put the translation, they put it at the feet of the master. It's not perfect, but it's got, "I tried to master Kachin. There are defects of my work. It's a heartfelt gratitude that he lays it at the feet." The vision in the end is the vision of Revelation 7. You see, our response has to be this vision. The vision is, "After this I looked and behold a great multitude that no one could number from every nation, all tribes and peoples and languages standing before the throne, before the Lamb, clothed with white robes, with the palm branches in their hands, crying out a loud voice, 'Salvation belongs to our God who sits on the throne and to the Lamb.'" That should be front and center when we wake up every morning. That should be what it's about. That vision should drive us, because we are declaring the excellences of Him who called us out of darkness into His marvelous light. Once we had no mercy, now we actually have mercy. And then not only that, we not only proclaim, but we also live the life. Proclamation and light witness. "Behold, beloved, I urge you as sojourners and exiles to abstain from the passions of flesh which wage war against your soul. Keep your conduct among Gentiles honorable, so that when they speak of you as evildoers, they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day of visitation." Here, the proclamation of worship is basically we're the chosen race. We've got a purpose to proclaim His excellencies and our lives to live out as a counterculture, sojourners and exiles in honorable conduct. And if you look at here, how do we live in such a way to proclaim His excellencies, right? This is how the world looks at God looks at us, chosen race, royal priesthood. Here's how the world should see us, aliens and strangers. How are we aliens and strangers? Because we don't live like the world. You see, we are to abstain from the passions of the flesh which wage war against your soul. The passions of the flesh, when you talk about this, "Oh, my murderous desire to strangle you." That's not what it means. Or totally lustful desire to have sex with every woman you come across. See, when you talk about passions and lusts, it comes to the actual word in Greek is epithymias, which is basically normal desire, but overly. What are your normal desires in the human being? Well, you want comfort, you want safety, you want love, you want food, you want security, you want work, isn't it? Legitimate desires. When epithymias means over desire, too much of a good thing. I want comfort, but I want comfort so much that I must buy a $20,000 bed. When a $5,000 bed will do, or a $500 bed. There are some beds that go even $1 million. But it's over desire. I want love, or I love my children so much until your children becomes your idol. All right, or food. I love food. Legitimate to have your food, right? Everybody should have food. But you have so much desire for food that you buy a $25,000 hamburger or you eat until you're bursting at the side. So this is basically over desires. I've got to have it. So we live in a world where everybody's desires are unbridled. There's no control. There's not enough money for them to earn. You ask anybody, have you made enough money? Even John D. Rockefeller, they ask you, have you made enough? No, $1 more. Even the richest person will tell you, I need a dollar more. But the way we live is not in over-desire. And the way when we do that, the world will see, hey, you're crazy. You're like a stranger or an alien. And when they see that, they turn around and say, hey, what's wrong with this Christian? You're actually different. All right? Then the other one is keep your conduct honorable among Gentiles so that when they speak of you as evildoers, they may speak against you as evildoers, they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day of visitation. When they look at you, there are good works. There is change in character. It takes time. It's not overnight. It takes years and years for people to change their character. In fact, somebody once said the best person to know whether a person has changed, become a Christian is a man's horse. How you deal with his horse. This is in the old days, you know. Whether he kicks his horse or treats his horse well. But then there's a paradoxical response. No matter what you do, there will be some who call you evil and there will be some who admit you're good on the last day. There will be a conflict. There's an enigma. We are called evil. Why are we called evil in the world? I mean, if you're Christian, suppose a Christian, why are we seen as evil? Number one, because your good works show up bad behavior. John 1, everyone who does wicked things hates the light and does not come into the light lest his works be exposed. And so basically, they complain that Christians are always judging them. Just because you express a difference of opinion and because they've done evil, right? Taking bribe, okay, what? And you say, oh, no. The moment you say taking bribe, no, it means, oh, you're judging me. Yeah, obviously it's that. So basically, good works show up, bad behavior, always seen as evil. You're committed to the truth. Jesus says, sanctify them in the truth. Your word is truth. As you send me in the world, I've sent them into the world. And for their sake, I've consecrated myself that they also may be sanctified in the truth. Whatever it is, we are sticking to the truth. And when you stick to the truth, you are obviously going to get into trouble with the rest of the world around you. Allergic reaction, 2 Corinthians 2:15. For we are the aroma of Christ to God among those who are being saved, among those who are perishing, to one a fragrance of death to death, the other a fragrance of life to life. So you come and basically to one group of people who are becoming Christians, who are responding to the gospel, you bring life. The other group, you bring judgment. So therefore, they don't like you at all. They also think you're stupid because 1 Corinthians chapter 1:8 says, for the word of God of the cross is folly to those who are perishing, but to those of us who are being saved, it is the power of God. So if they think it's wonderful, it means they're already Christian, isn't it? If they think your message that you bring is stupid, well, you're supposed to be stupid because they are perishing. All right, so these are some of the reasons we are seen as evil. And the cross is something that is folly. If you look at recently in Penang, I think there were some stamps, isn't it, of some churches. That also they get upset about. All right, and there was some developer who put up some lights in Penang, right? It looks like a cross. And people get upset for nothing, all right, because the cross is basically something folly to them. This, can you imagine they were upset with but this cross? Guess where this cross was? New York City, Twin Towers, you know, these two steel girders came together accidentally, and they put him up because it was like a miracle, as it were. So, you know, it showed the presence of God in that area, and it, and a lot of people complained about the cross being put up as a memorial there. You've got recently the Alabama State House, which actually passed a law that says abortion is wrong. Big, big deal, you know, because in America, Roe versus Wade, 1973, says abortion is okay. Now they're trying to overturn it, and for the first time, they outlawed abortion in Alabama State. And this is one of the presidential candidates in the Democratic Party. She writes, "One of the tenets of our democracy is that we are separation of church and state. Under no circumstances are we supposed to be imposing our faith on other people." But she doesn't realize that the support of abortion is imposing secular values and faiths upon the people of faith. That means the people of faith cannot express their values. But the people who have no faith can express their values. You see, having no faith, that means secular is also a religion. Right? So you cannot have your cake and eat it. All right? What's wrong with this cake? If I asked you to bake this cake, what's wrong with it? Would you bake this cake? Huh? Any problem? Yeah, gay people, rainbow. Some people won't, you know, bake this cake because it's you know, it's rainbow, you know. But the moment you say, "I don't want to bake this cake, I'm anti-gay, this is hate speech, this is homophobic, intolerant against human rights." Again, it's imposing one view on the rest of the world and ask, and forcing them to basically comply. This is Canada. Canada actually had the Trinity Western University actually wanted to put a law school up. And in their law school, all the students signed a pledge to be, you know what, to marry the opposite sex and to be faithful to the opposite sex. Because of that, the Supreme Court said that they cannot be registered as barristers in law because it's against human rights. So their pledge to marry heterosexual people was in contravention of human rights. So we live in a difficult situation. In a school in New York, and they were having this American Pie, which is a song. And they look at the song. It says, "Did you write the book of love? And did you have faith in God above? If the Bible tells you so, do you believe in rock and roll?" Actually, when the children sang it, they changed it. "Everybody tells you so." They rub up the Bible. And the subtle response for Christians is that we need to compromise. We cannot mention Bible because Bible upset them. You know, why are we so afraid about them being upset? What about us being upset because you deny my right for expression of my faith? You cannot deny my right for expression of my faith. All right? Recently, Scott Morrison, a known Pentecostal Christian, became a Prime Minister of Australia again. Instead of thanking God, you know what he says? "It's a miracle." Imagine if we had said, "Thank God, Mati," the whole country will wallop him. So we actually have to basically compromise very subtly. This is a very controversial pastor called Danny Nalia. He actually worships in Victoria, New South Wales. What happened was that in 2005, they had a seminar. And during a seminar, him and another pastor were giving lessons on how to counter Muslims inside the church. And what they did was actually read from the Quran and showed that how it actually had values which were inconsistent with love or Christian values. And what they did was the Victorian Islamic Council sent undercover white people who were Muslims into the seminar and recorded and wrote down what he said and put him up on charges of basically hate speech. Because Victoria has a very funny law. Victoria has a law that says it prohibits conduct that incites hatred, serious contempt, revulsion, severe ridicule of a person or a group of people based on religious beliefs. This is called the Racial and Religious Tolerance Act. Okay? It's the only state that does this, you know. And based on this, the judge found him and the other pastor guilty. And basically, when they actually went to the court of law and fought, what Daniel and I said, "Look, I wasn't inciting hatred. What I was doing, I was reading from the Quran." So he stood up in the courtroom and he read from the Quran. You know, the lawyer said, "You cannot read from the Quran." You know why? Truth is not a defense. How stupid it is. truth is not a defense. They lost the case, but then it was appealed to the Victorian Supreme Court. And the Victorian Supreme Court said, as noted, the judges pointed out that Section 8 of the Act, unlike related paragraphs in this Commonwealth anti-racism legislation, does not focus on whether a group or persons have been offended, but whether hatred or other negative emotions have been incited against such persons. These laws have implications for even our country. It's what Danny and Alia was doing was not inciting hatred. He was, they took offense equals hatred. Offense doesn't mean hatred. In fact, they have an out-of-court settlement, and they agreed, the Muslims and the Christians agreed, the rights of each other, their community, and all persons within the limits provided for by law to robustly debate religion, including the right to criticize the religious belief of another in a free and open democratic society. This is a win. This is a win. Because Danny and Alia stood up, he could have capitulated and run away with his tail between his legs. Danny and Alia is a very controversial pastor. He actually became a politician later on. He did very funny things. You know, he said, you know, in Black Saturday, where they have got a few bushfires, people died because God is punishing them because they were promoted abortion. All right? So, and then he claimed to raise people from the dead. Christians are not perfect. Christians are not perfect, okay? But in this regard, he stood up for the faith and he made a difference in that part of the country. I want to end with a story of Mary Neal. She's an orthopedic surgeon who went in kayaking in a South American country. She was actually underneath a waterfall, and that waterfall actually caused her to drown. She was without oxygen for 24 minutes. As you know, 24 minutes is, you're dead. Your brain is bereft of oxygen. They managed to bring her up. She was totally purple, resuscitated her. And she actually subsequently wrote of an experience how she was transported to heaven. I know a lot of people who talk about that. But the important thing is that, is not that. Is that when she came back, after 24 minutes of no oxygen at all, she actually had no loss of brain power. There was no stroke. There was nothing. She was completely well, which is actually a miracle on its own. And she was giving a TED talk I was listening to, and she brought out this picture. What do you see? Anybody? Huh? Two men. How many people say two men? Right. Okay. What else do you see? Huh? A what? A cup. A goblet, right? So some of you see a goblet. Some of you see a cup, isn't it? Right? And what she said was very, very insightful. This cup represents our time on earth. And the two faces represent our true spiritual home, which is what she went to heaven and about. You could just focus on the cup, but you would miss your true spiritual home. Or you could focus on your time on earth and you miss your true spiritual home. Or you could focus on heaven and your time on earth would just be passing the time and you would have wasted the time. She challenges us to look at both. You see, the cup becomes more meaningful in the light of the two faces there. We have to live with our eye on both, because the two faces accentuates the meaning of the cup. It forms the meaning of the cup. You see, when we understand our true spiritual identity as the chosen race, the holy priesthood, royal priesthood, holy nation, God's special people, created to worship Him, then you'll wake up to the great potential in your life, to how God is going to transform your life here in the light of what's going to come. You'll be more aware of metaphysical things. Problems become opportunities. Love becomes the only thing that matters, she writes. And the door to experiencing God's presence in your daily life begins to open more profoundly. And joy becomes something that's constant state. Because whenever you live, you look at this, you always look in the light of who we are, a royal priesthood, a holy nation. That is the challenge. Most of us didn't die for 24. It didn't have to take us to die for 24 minutes, right? But the Holy Bible tells us our true spiritual home, what we really are. And when we can see ourselves today in the light of what's going to happen in the future, then we really know how to live. All right? All right, see you next week. On the 12th of...